Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and welcome particularly to the 42nd Culture File Weekly, the most 42nd-ish weekly there's ever been. And this weekly we discover how a secret model train hobby has somehow steered a new version of the comic opera Coppelia. We celebrate George Boole with a pudding made in his honour at UCC. The ambassador from the place she likes to call the Czechlands tells us about her national day, and Richard Herring explores the territory between innovative comedy and gratuitous offence. But first, Coppelia. A no longer secret model railway habit is one of the inspirations behind a new version of the proto-sci-fi ballet Coppelia. Playwright Stella Feely's contemporised version, written for choreographer Morgan Runacre Temple, begins a national tour this week. At the home of her husband, Max Stafford Clark's Out of Joint Theatre Company in Holloway, the London-born, Donegal-raised playwright told Culturefile about the beauty myth and the rarefied attractions of Boone, Iowa.
The original Coppelia is a ballet written in 1870. Music's by Delibes, choreography Arthur Saint-Leon, and the libretto by Charles Nuitet. And the story is that of an eccentric toy maker and his beautiful doll. He is obsessed with the doll and wishes to bring her to life. But not only that, there's a young man in the town who is engaged to be married to the beautiful Swanhilda, and he's become infatuated with the doll. He sees her in a window, and one day he decides that he's going to declare his love to her. But it's also the day that Swanhilda decides that she's going to confront her love rival. Anyway, all sorts of comedy chaos ensues from this scenario. In our version, Dr. Coppelius is a Svengali Simon Cowell / Howard Hughes type. He's the a cosmetic manufacturer and is the creator of a famous beauty soap, sort of like Lux or Camé in the 50s, called Coppelia soap. And the face of that soap is a very beautiful woman called Coppelia. And but what the public don't know, who've been buying the soap and its truckloads, is that Coppelia is actually a doll. He brings her to open the county fair. He's so arrogant and believes so much in the reality of his creation, he can actually bring her into the public eye so long as nobody comes near her. And all goes well until basically her battery winds down. And then they find that Coppelia, this famous model, is actually a doll. So suddenly these kids are in terrible, terrible danger because Coppelius is a millionaire by the mere fact of this product, but he's also obsessed with his doll too. We've set the ballet in Boone, Iowa, in 1959. Boone is a city in the township of Des Moines, and it's the population is 12,600 people, and the population in 1970 was 12,400 people, so it's very much a rural place. It's a vast place, it's agricultural, and I just thought, well, and there's a very famous county fair there. So I just thought about this really eternal, tiny city where people pretty much stay at home. And so the idea that people move out to the city, it just doesn't happen. People stay and they stay on their farms. So I like the idea of these really small town people, this beautiful model coming in, people falling in love with her. They hadn't, you know. And also that if the laboratory's on the outskirts of town, people don't really know much about it. So it was the idea of a small city in a big country, and the idea of her sort of national fame in a huge country interested me.
So how did you end up in Boone?
My husband is a model train fanatic. He collects...
This is Max Stafford Clark.
Max Stafford Clark, my husband, yeah. He collects model trains. And his model... And we have a train set in our house. The room is a tiny little room, which I was always wishing would be my walk-in wardrobe or even a guest room, is Max's train room. And his train collections from the 1940s up to the 1960s, and it's set in Vermont. It really, really is quite spectacular. So he's always talking about the various train lines, and he has his own train line called Norfolk Coast. Oh, he'll kill me now for talking. It's basically like talking about your secret, you know, porn stash or something. But yeah, it's Max. That's Max's secret. He's got a train set. And so it's him talking about the train line. And I think there's still like a vintage, there's like steam railway that runs there. So it's that sense of the trains and in America, the expanse. Yeah. Fortunately, I've only ever been to Vermont and then New York. I've just visited it through his train obsession. Yeah. How we first started talking about it was looking at images in magazines, in that every image that women, young and old, are airbrushed. And I talked to Morgan about an incident that I'd had 2 years previously in a New York department store. I just happened to be looking at this serum, this Tracy Martin's firming serum, and this woman came up and tried to sell me it, and she said, would I like to try it? And I was saying, no, I was just really looking at it. And she was saying it would really help you. Now, in New York, I often find that people are terribly impertinent in shops. So you're holding up a pair of jeans and then somebody will say, come over and say, sorry, madam, she says, but they do have them in a larger size, that sort of thing. Or if you're looking at an eye cream, they'll say, that's very good for the lines under your eyes. So in this sense, this woman was sort of having this similar conversation with me. And then she pulled out two pictures. One was of Kate Winslet and the other was Diane van Forstenberg. And they're completely airbrushed. And she said, they use this and look at how beautiful their skin is. I said, but you're showing me airbrushed photographs. Sure, Kate Winslet's nearly 40. She's the mother of three kids. You know, and Diane van Forstenberg, she's 70 if she's a day. They're both gorgeous women, you know, don't get me wrong. But I said, you cannot tell me that this cream is going to make me look like them, because they don't even look like that. Anyway, that was the beginning of that conversation.
What did she say?
Oh, God. She just started stammering. Because I'm Irish, then you kind of backpedal on yourself. Like, I nearly bought it just because I felt so bad about ruining her day. But I said, well, maybe you're right. You know, I did backpedal because you just, as an Irish person, you just can't be that rude.
Stella Feely there, and Ballet Ireland's Coppelia continues its national tour at the Theatre Royal in Castle Bar on Monday night before crisscrossing the country and passing within 10 miles of your door, I'm betting. Now, accidental Corkman George Boole has been the subject of many celebrations in this, his bicentennial year, but the one organised by UCC food and culinary historian Regina Sexton might be the tastiest. Sexton is celebrating the 19th century mathlete, not in sums, but with a pudding. Caroline Hennessy met Sexton and attempted to make George Boole College pudding.
So this morning I'm going to see if I can make this pudding and if it is adapted to 21st century tastes. And the ingredients are nothing out of the extraordinary. We've got lovely raisins, sherry, things like flour, breadcrumbs. The only thing that Regina said she actually changed was to use butter instead of suet, which would be much lighter for puddings these days, whereas suet was really needed when we had people out working the fields in all weather, so they needed that good, strong, bolstering suet in their diets. But this is isn't too complicated at all. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to start with 110 grams of raisins. Now, Regina, George Boole isn't a name that we would associate with food normally. Why is he so important to UCC?
Well, George Boole, originally from Lincoln, was the university's first professor of maths. And he was the first professor because the university opened in the middle of the 19th century. And George Boole came without any qualification. Actually, it was quite extraordinary. But his genius was recognised, I suppose. So he came to UCC at the end of the 1840s in 1849 as the new university's first professor of maths. And while he was here in Cork, he produced, I suppose, his seminal work, The Laws of Thought, which in time, well, it was about algebra and a new system of mathematics and logic and so on. And his thinking around this new system that he, I suppose, thought up would in time become the foundation of the information age. So anything that we do in terms of modern technology, we can trace back to the way Boole thought about numbers and maths in his head. So I suppose that's why the university this year, it's his 200th birthday. His birthday is on the 2nd of November. So I suppose that's why the university is so excited about their connection with George Boole and his posting here. And I suppose that's why we want to acknowledge and celebrate him as much as we can this year.
You have also come up with a kind of a birthday cake, as it were, for George Boole.
I'm glad you see it this way, because that's what I was thinking too, that his birthday is coming. And in fact, the university are going to make the puddings for the staff restaurant on that day. But I think, interestingly, what you said is that when we think of George Boole, even if we have heard of him and we might think of him associated with maths and so on, you know, for many people, we have to be honest, that mightn't be very kind of exciting or so on. So the university also thought then that for some of the celebrations that we would look at, maybe if we could look at maybe George Boole the man and so on. So they had various different projects throughout the year, looking at his family tree, his genealogy and so on. I have to say that that Professor Des McHale has written the authoritative biography of George Boole. But I also went back and I looked at some of his letters, because when he was in the university, he wrote a lot of letters, like texting, back home to his friends and his colleagues, but very sort of personal and insightful letters to his mother and his sister Marianne. And it's in those letters that I came across the references to food. And I suppose that's why I was intrigued then by what he saw, but also his reaction to what he saw, because that gives us, I think, something of the humanity behind this world famous mathematician. You see something of his thought process and how he felt.
And of course, he would have been posted here, or he started his job here in UCC in 1849, which would have been a time of enormous hardship throughout Ireland, the tail end of the Irish famine, still with lots of blight in the fields. But he didn't have an experience that really corresponded to our image of Ireland at that time.
His first experience of Ireland was on his journey from Dublin to Cork, when he was coming down, just new into the country, to take up his post. And the first thing that struck him was he was looking out around him. Obviously, the journey was much slower than it would be today. So he looked out around him and he was struck by the desolation, destitute of the fields, nothing there, full of weeds. So he was struck by that initially. But then when he came to the city, he saw a city that was full of food and abundantly available. And he talks about that in the letters back home, that he says, you know, there's lots here and it's cheap. Particularly, he says, the salmon and the fowl is cheap. And then he gives us descriptions of his landlady and she presenting tables that are just absolutely, literally groaning with food for him. And then he starts to engage in a sort of a social round of dining, because he's a professor of maths, the university is new, so everybody wants to invite him to their party. He becomes integrated in that aspect of, I suppose, an elite culture in Cork, you know, dining with the bishops and notables like the Beamish family and so on. And in one letter in particular, he says it's a big gathering of a dinner. He says that it started towards the end of the 1840s again. He says it starts with turtle soup and champagne. And he says that, you know, that this overt extravagance is in poor taste in the times they're in.
Then we're going to add the nutmeg. So it says 1 teaspoon of freshly ground nutmeg. And freshly ground nutmeg. It's even just opening.
What Boole does is that he observes the food culture, I suppose. But what I did to look at the kind of the culinary culture that was behind that was I looked at an unpublished collection of 19th century recipes that are also in the Boole Library. And these, I thought it was just fortuitous that the timing was good. They're contemporary recipes by a woman started in the 1820s by a woman from around Kinsale called Mary Horner. And it's a book handwritten in several hands, actually, about 200 recipes. So she has one for college pudding, A college pudding is something part of the repertoire of British kind of culinary tradition. You know, it's not an Irish recipe, and most of Mary Horner's aren't Irish recipes anyway. So I took that one out, had a look at it, and I adapted it a small bit, and then we just, I suppose, just to play around with it a small bit, we called it George Boole's College Pudding.
So that's the George Boole College Pudding, made in my 19th century cottage. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating, but at the moment it's in the baking. So we'll have to wait until it comes out to have a taste test of it. But if it tastes as good as it was smelling going in, with ingredients like raisins and cherries, candied lemon peel, lots and lots of nutmeg, it should come out tasting really, really nice. But now, from the 21st century equipment that I was able to use to record and measure this, back to the 19th century for me, and no dishwasher here in the cottage. So I've got to get all these bowls and utensils and wooden spoons and spatulas and start the tap running and get down to my washing up.
Caroline Hennessy there talking to Regina Sexton, and in answer to your unspoken question, no, not a taste. You're listening to the Culture File Weekly on RTE Lyric FM. On Wednesday this week, Czech Independence Day was celebrated here on Culturefile, and indeed in that place they call the Czech lands. So we asked Ambassador of the Czech Republic to Ireland, Mrs. Hanna Motlová, to tell us more, including why some people prefer the term Czech lands.
In Czech lands of that time, it was not the question of any revolution, but it was the political aftermath after World War I. So at that time, the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy dissolved, and they had their own vision how to maybe come to grips with the new situation after World War I. But it was somehow overcome by the developments, and the Czechs and Slovaks together decided to actually proclaim their independence. And they did it publicly on 28th of October 1918 in Wenceslas Square in Prague in the central. So there was the proclamation of Czechoslovak independence. And so the National Day since then is associated with this date. We kept it because we thought that it's a sort of a really the very strongest bond with our heritage and historical development. So in that sense, the whole Czech Republic was a concept of continuation of Czechoslovakia in a way. So we kept many things from that period, including the anthem and other things. So it was because of its nature that there was not, again, any big revolution, any big drastic developments. So we thought it would be the right way. And people felt in the same way, and our political leadership, that there's a continuation of the Czechoslovak heritage. Since I'm here, in Dublin and in Ireland, serving for the diplomatic service here, I try to do it in a sense that it would be a more general knowledge of that day. And it also it's quite important because in Ireland there are a few thousands Czechs living here. So I think it would be also a moment for them to reflect and think of their homeland. Bohemian and Moravia, they were part of the statehood entity in that part of, you know, in Central Europe, was part of the kingdom of the Czech crown for many centuries, since 9th century until the beginning of 17th century. Bohemia, well, sometimes people do not get it immediately that you speak about part of the world that I was born in. So I like to say Czechlands now I think that people also use Czechia, but I myself like Czechlands. those people who know the music, Czech music, Bedřich Smetana, you know, his symphonic pieces. It's all about Czech lands, about the countryside, about the river Moldau, Vltava, and then you have all these beautiful places in the Czech lands for me. It's very personal. But I really would like to mention one, a very, very long tradition in the Czech lands, and it's 11th of November, 11-11, which is St. Martin's Day. And it's a long tradition associated with this because in Czech lands at those times, it was mostly expected that the first snowflakes may appear. And there was the saying that, that this day, St. Martin's will come on a white horse, meaning it might snow that day. But this day was always celebrated also in a specific way because a golden roasted goose was served on this day. That goose was accompanied with potato or bread dumplings and red cabbage. And also there's a specific thing, that's the time for serving young wine. So there's a special, many years the wine sellers, they produce a specific type of wine, which is called St. Martin's wine. And of course, this is the day to taste it. If you are in the Czech lands, many places, many restaurants actually have a special St. Martin's menu on this day and also before that. I'll tell you something. I was here many times before my current posting, but one of my first day here was as a university student. I got a scholarship. I studied here a little bit. And of course, as a proper university student, I work in a bar in Dublin, and I had few customers and they always ask for the Czech beer, and they already was a quite famous place with, I think at that time they were serving about 40 different types of beer, of course only few on draft, but the others bottled. And few people, as I said, few customers, regular customers really, they came and they always asked the Czech beer. And so first time, second time and third time, and I served them, I said, "Why do you order this?" And they said, "This is the best beer in the whole world."
Excellency Mrs. Hanna Motlová there from the Czech lands, agitating for good beer.
I really advise you to check it.
We heard from British comedian Richard Herring previously on Culturefile when he'd begun to establish himself as something of a kingpin of British comedy podcasting. But the move online has only encouraged him to look again at the many hours of jokes, or shows as they're often called, that he's created, going as far this year as reviving and relearning his whole stand-up oeuvre. He talked to Culturefile about some of those possibly timeless classics.
Who's the man you should really be scared of? The man proudly wearing this moustache out in the open? Or the man surreptitiously trying out in clandestine circumstances, never telling us all, laughing about how funny he is?
My job does take over my life to a certain extent. I think that's an interesting thing to explore, you know, through comedy. I mean, it is slightly worrying sometimes you think, you know, actually, if I'm doing this for a show, I'm more likely to do it than if it was for my actual life. And sometimes when you're doing as much as I am at the moment, it's very hard to have a life outside of, you know, when you're thinking of an idea, it does take over. But if you're writing anything, that's the case. You know, if you're writing a book or any kind of show or whatever, you will get taken over by the idea. So living with a writer is a hard enough thing in itself, I think, anyway. Part of what my show's about is the fear as a comedian that you're playing around with your own mental balance, I think, you know, a little bit. So when I had a Hitler moustache, I had to walk around with a toothbrush moustache for the best part of a year, and it wasn't massively pleasant most of the time, you know, and it did probably have an effect on my psychology and my weight, definitely. I ate a lot to try and get, and drank a lot to try and get through it. So it does have an effect.
It's, I know when I looked at it, I expected to laugh when I first shaved down to this moustache, but it seemed like a funny idea on paper, this. But I looked at myself in the mirror, I couldn't even smile. For about the first week I had this moustache, I was just in a permanent grimace, like looking, frowning, like the weight of history was dragging my face downwards. Because I just looked so evil, and I started to worry maybe it was the moustache that was responsible for Hitler's crimes. Because
I think for me, if you're going to be laughing at other people and other things, you need to be able to laugh at yourself. And I think, obviously you know yourself better than anything else. I think if you could be honest about yourself, or even, exaggerate slightly your flaws or whatever, that I think there's a lot of comedy in that. But I think actually by being honest about the stupid things one has done, and I don't think I've done anything, I'm quite a regular person, really, in the reality of myself rather than maybe the podcast version of myself. But, I think it is interesting to look into oneself. And I think when I started out doing comedy in my early 20s, I would have been too worried to talk about anything even remotely personal. But I think to open up yourself in an artistic sense, I think, and to be honest about yourself as you can be from your own perspective, I think is a really interesting position to take. And a lot of my favourite artists in all sorts of mediums are the ones who are prepared to really hold up the mirror to themselves and really have a proper look into it, whereas I think other people will create a very false persona. And I think I probably did that early on. And even now, there has to be a reason why you're being offensive, even if the reason is just to upset people. And there's nothing wrong with upsetting people. There's nothing wrong with offending people, I don't think. But I think you have to choose the right people to offend.
And look at the people of India and Pakistan, right? They hate each other. They're always fighting. There could be nuclear war between those two countries that will destroy the world. If only the people of India and Pakistan could see themselves the way a racist sees them.
I like to think that people will come and see something before they judge it, but all the people who've taken against Christ on a bike and Hitler moustache to a certain extent hadn't seen the show. And Christians who come and see that show generally really like it and actually at least respect it, or at least they don't have to agree with all of it. Of course, they don't necessarily agree with all of it, but they can see that I've researched it. It's a silly show, it's a confrontational show in some places, but it's well researched and they're making some interesting points, and it's my point of view, so it's that I'm not going to go into a church and say, hold on, I'm an atheist, I find this offensive, will you please stop doing it. And I don't think the people who protested shouldn't be allowed to protest. They should be allowed to protest, but I think they're in a stronger position if they've seen the show and know what it's about. And really nobody who's seen it has given me a hard time about anything, because I think in the end it's actually a very pro-Jesus show.
I do believe it, I do. I've just been showing off to try and impress girls. I don't think it worked. I've always believed in you. I've just been waiting till the last possible minute to repent. It's a weakness in your system, if I'm honest.
I think you're taking controversial subjects. I don't really think, when I did Hitler Moustache, I didn't even think, this having a picture of me as Hitler on the poster will upset people, because I thought it was clear, if you were doing a play about Hitler and the poster was you dressed up as Hitler, people wouldn't think, I expect that's a pro-Hitler play. You would probably assume the opposite. So I don't know why, because it's a comedy show, some people think, you shouldn't make jokes about certain subjects. But I think if you do it with a responsibility and thought, and I do think very hard about my stuff. So something like Christ on the Bike is although I do ad-lib in it, it is a script, and it is something I've thought very hard about, and I'm trying, everything that's in there is in there for a reason. It's working out is it worth the level of fence to buy whatever joke you're doing? Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. So there's been a couple of bits in Christ the Bike that I've taken out just because I didn't think they were worth upsetting people over. I think comedy is a great way of talking about serious subjects. There's no subject I think is out of reach for comedy. Frankie Ball's disability stuff I didn't like personally, but I think disability is a great thing to talk about in comedy, because it's these things that we hide away that need to be discussed, and comedy is a great way of doing it, and talking about a serious subject and letting everyone have a laugh, but also hopefully a little seed of, that's quite interesting.
Exciting, that one. Did you enjoy that? Yeah? Did it shock you? A little bit? £5.60 that cost. As I think, if God was going to try and strike someone down, he'd miss by a little bit, wouldn't he? And then he'd just send up quite a big puff of smoke and a bit of a bang. Miss, it'd be exactly, I think, 2 metres away from the audience, exactly conforming with health and safety regulations. I think that's what...
Richard Herring there, and you can find DVD records of many of his shows at gofasterstripe.com. His current tour is called Happy Now and is on the road till June 2016. I'll be back with the next Culture File Weekly at 6:30 p.m. next Saturday evening, and of course each weekday evening with the Eveningly Culture File in Liz Nolan's Classic Drive at 5:40 p.m. Until we meet again, bye now.